Years ago in 1984, John Gage from Sun Microsystems famously coined the phrase, "The network is the computer." And when we think about how AI models work today, especially large language models, both training and also inference, that's really never been more true than it is now. Training AI models like GPT and Claude, and even much smaller models, means thousands or tens of thousands, or with some models even approaching 100,000 GPUs connected together with ultra-high performance networking in specialized data centers so that they can all work together to make the magic of ChatGPT and Llama and Claude actually happen. Now, the problem is that for most of us, for most organizations, training your own model can be kind of a problem. The cost and the logistics of retrofitting or even building a specialized AI data center, it's just crazy. GPUs are insanely expensive, and sometimes it really is just a moot point because you can't get the power to your data center that you want to retrofit. So what do? This is where NeoClouds come in, a new type of cloud service provider. And it's what we're talking about on today's show. So with me is Dave Cliff, a product manager at Kentik and an SME on cloud technologies, and we'll be unpacking NeoClouds. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Cliff, thanks so much for joining the podcast today. It's been great to know you, to meet you only this last March, I think, at our all company offsite. So that was great to kind of chit chat with you and meet you for the first time. And now here we are recording a podcast together. But before we get started, I call you Cliff. The name on the screen here on our recording software says Cliff. But the social media card for this podcast and, you know, when I email you, says Dave or David. Can you, what's going on there?
That is so strange. I wonder why. No, I have some background there for sure. This goes all the way back to high school calculus class. I remember Mr. Hayhurst affectionately used to call me Cliff, and he called on me often. I'm not entirely sure why. A calculus was something that I enjoyed a lot, so maybe it stemmed from that, but definitely picked up again when I spent a lot of time at PagerDuty, kind of from Series A through IPO. We had a lot of Daves at the time, even in product management, where I am with Kentik now, and so. Yeah, in order to disambiguate the many Daves, Cliff became the moniker and stuck. I think my Twitter handle for a while was Cliffhangers, Cliff with the E, of course, and that's kind of stuck on LinkedIn as well now. So, definitely still respond as Cliff. There are fewer Cliffs in the world, and thank goodness for that.
Okay, very good. So you're a product manager at Kentik. And I know that you're focused very much on the cloud, but what does that mean? I know what a product manager does, but you personally and what your role is, and especially for Kentik, but specifically in the context of cloud, since we're going to be getting into the whole concept of NeoCloud in a couple minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that you know what a product manager is, because sometimes I wonder in my day to day.
Dictionary is all I know.
Right? A dictionary. That's right. Yeah. No, you can ask Gemini that nowadays. Product management. I mean, man, I've been doing this for probably close to 15 years now. It's definitely evolved in terms of a discipline from like early Microsoft days when I was there, and it was called program manager. And it kind of became there was a whole manual written on what it was, and then program management kind of split a little bit. And I'm definitely more of the kind of Marty Kagan kind of product manager, in terms of just focusing on what is valuable, usable, and feasible, breaking it down that way. And at Kentik, that's thankfully consistent. I love that we kind of work in more of a triad model with designers, with engineering counterparts, and kind of bringing those kind of three elements into what we build at Kentik. And so in terms of the cloud experience, we've got our heads in the cloud, in many clouds, in fact. And so And so it's we support AWS, Azure, GCP, OCI, definitely more to come in the future, certainly as customers continue to bring workloads from all over the place, multi-cloud that I'm sure we'll touch on in a little bit, and kind of the network implications to that. But there's a lot of network activity and that people want to analyze and understand in their cloud environments. And so we're trying to make sense of all of that activity that people are seeing, because I mean, network is truth. That's what I heard from a customer recently. That is the way they think about it, especially in their cloud environment. That's the way that you kind of know really what's going on, is what's on the wire.
Well, why don't we expand upon that a little bit? The network is truth. You just said that that's how you know what's going on, because you see what's on the wire. Can you expand on that? What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of observability in particular is really kind of focused heavily on metrics. And those are really important elements of really what is going on within your environment. Logging of individual processes on your servers, et cetera. But really, like, what is going on within the network is ultimately going to be the truth of of what you're trying to analyze. Sometimes the metrics can lead you astray. You really do need to kind of get down to that log level. Metrics in many ways are kind of a way of optimizing the way that you look and finding that needle in a haystack oftentimes. But if you really want to get down to, okay, what happens specifically, in the communication between this instance and that instance, or this instance out to the internet, to some other cloud potentially, really you need to be able to look at and understand what is that flow. And so it's really, really exciting and interesting, certainly being at Kentik and trying to make sense of the massive network flow data that we look at, and the trillions and trillions of records that we kind of help to process in our customers' environments every year.
Yeah. Yeah. The way I have said it many times on this podcast and in other places, that, I'm sitting here at my computer and the vast majority of the applications I use, maybe 75%, 85% of the apps on my computer are not on my computer. It's a web interface or maybe some kind of a local application that's connecting over the internet to the actual application. Yeah. And so an application's slow, or it's not working properly, or the data is not properly, populating in the fields. Very often it's a matter of it's a network problem. And if it's not a network problem, then maybe it's the interface between the network and the application or something along those lines. Now, yes, sometimes it's the application, right? We can't just give them a free pass here. A lot of the time
everybody points at the network, though, Phil. Come on.
But I mean, I'm just trying to be realistic that, if you have a front end in AWS, a back end in Azure, and you're doing some sort of like AI training in a NeoCloud, which we're going to talk about today, and then, you have your own flaky, old school wireless modem router thing two floors away from you. I mean, the network is critical in an application's performance and then your experience with it. And then that's just what it is today. And so I would say that most people are living in this hybrid multi-cloud SaaS world, whether you realize it or not. When was the last time you installed like Office products locally? I mean, that's just been, we use Google Apps, whatever it's called now, Workplace, whatever it is. But certainly even just simple mundane productivity tools, they're not on my computer for the most part, other than some developer tools and things like that. And even that's kind of migrating away from that as well.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I think that's a good segue into where we're going now. There's a cost benefit analysis that people do with like running stuff on premises, whether it's, your campus, rather your branch office. Do I run my productivity tools on my folks' laptops and desktop computers, or can we run it in Microsoft 365 or in Google Workspace? So you have a cost benefit analysis. But that's the same with the applications, front end, back end, serious stuff like, our storage environments, our high performance computing environment, all of that stuff. Do we also run that across campus in our on-prem data center? Maybe the answer is yes, but increasingly it's no, and we all know that. That's not news. And what I wanted to talk about today was how that relates to this new concept. The concept isn't new, but specifically the context of AI training, this new term, neocloud. And, you know, if you're like me and you got your feeds and you're getting your Twitter feeds and your LinkedIn feeds and maybe you got RSS feeds still going, you've probably seen that term. I'm speaking to the audience, Cliff. I know you have. Yeah. You've probably seen that term. And if you haven't, you know, and it's a new term, great. I'm hoping that you learned something today. Let's unpack that. What is a neocloud? You know, what is it for? Why did it develop? Why do they exist? Who are the notable players? Those are the kind of things I want to unpack now. So let's start with Cliff, your definition.
Yeah, I mean, neo comes from the Latin of, no, I'm just, I don't have that much education, honestly. Yeah, it really is just new cloud. And largely, I mean, this is really just kind of purpose-built clouds is the way that I think of it. In this particular case, it's purpose-built for AI workloads. And so that does mean certainly involving GPUs, as you can imagine, as most of our listeners are probably, picturing in their heads as well. And a lot of it's been, you know, kind of just born out of GPU scarcity to a large extent that we can kind of get into. But yeah, it really is as simple as just like these are purpose-built clouds that are optimized for, AI workloads for training new models, for in certain cases fine tuning as well, and kind of inference on top of that. And so there's that's really what kind of neocloud is. It's a really interesting set of workloads because again, it's not general purpose like most of kind of what people think of as traditional now kind of cloud providers.
And that's going to be the main difference, that they are purpose built. Or in some cases, purpose rebuilt, right? Because they're repurposing like their crypto farm thing.
That's true, yeah.
But in any case, they are different than our traditional clouds and maybe hyperscalers in that they aren't general purpose.
Right. It's what you call an effective pivot right there.
Yeah, I mean, there you go.
My goodness.
Yeah. So just to level set on why this is important, when we're training an AI model, and right now we're generally talking about large language models. That doesn't have to be the case, but let's stick with large language models. You're talking about training runs that could take a very long time, where the entire training of a new model, like GPT-5 just came out recently, might take 6 months, 7 months, something like that. And in that time, you have thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, perhaps even approaching 100,000 GPUs operating in clusters that all have to talk to each other in order to process, you know, an enormous amount of data, and ultimately they're going through, you know, math and back propagation and all that kind of stuff to come up with a model that's accurate, that's consistent, and everybody says, okay, we're good, we're done training. The interesting thing is, you remember that quote by John Gage from Sun Systems, where he said, the network is the computer, right? So you got to think of it like this. All of these GPUs have to speak to each other, and they speak to each other in a very specific way, which we're not going to really get into today, but it's a synchronous communication, and they usually speak to each other in these huge flows and not necessarily these consistent dribbles. Yeah. That means in order for anything to happen with AI, training, or as you mentioned, inference, it all relies on that underlying network. So I think a lot of the time when we think of like traditional data center networking, except for like in finance where there's like super high performance and, you know, maybe things like that, science, generally, especially campus networking, but data center networking is not, it's not exactly the same. And you sort of start to think like, I just need those big, dumb, fat pipes of bandwidth and plenty of them, you know, and we're good. And then we don't even think about QoS because we have so much bandwidth, and we don't think about dropped packets because we have so much bandwidth, and we, you know, we have these links and we're, you know, subscribe 5-to-1, 3-to-1, whatever. And that's not the case for training an AI model in that kind of a data center. Right. And it's a little bit, you know, less so when you're talking about inference, but it's similar. So that's the kind of stuff happening in neoclouds. And, So let's talk about some of those characteristics. Like, what is it about, you know, the infrastructure, the speeds and feeds, the requirements of gear and hardware and architecture in a NeoCloud that kind of sets them apart? Because you mentioned that like AWS is more general purpose. Well, what do you mean by that exactly?
Yeah, I mean, it's that it's really kind of born out of the flexibility that's needed for, you know, obviously providing customers with different options for different types of apps that they might be building. You know, whether you're writing just like basic kind of client server app versus a bunch of like backend processing or, you know, asynchronous workflows, you know, there's very different requirements around like different storage solutions you may want to use for your, for building your app. And so, you know, the cloud providers, I think the major ones, certainly AWS, Azure, GCP, OCI, like these, they've really kind of gone and provided customers with a lot of options and making sure that they've kind of have some, you know, some kind of tailored capabilities effectively for these type different types of apps, which is really, really nice. And then there, you know, in terms of networking, it is fairly, you know, it's fairly consistent. It's your typical kind of TCP/IP, you know, Ethernet based communication, at least in terms of them building out data centers. And that's where, you know, it's been fascinating to see kind of this NeoCloud build out process. And, you know, we, a couple of the top players, certainly in this space are, you know, customers of ours that we have conversations with and interactions with. So it's really neat to be able to kind of peek under the covers a little bit and understand, you know, hey, this is not really, it's not just GPUs, certainly, because that's obviously the kind of compute side of things, but you still need storage, you still need networking, you know, in order to kind of, you know, ensure that these things can talk, and then you can actually kind of build, you know, build kind of processing into it. And so, you know, storage systems that are more optimized for these, this kind of workload, as well as network in particular, is, you know, is very, very different in terms of the way that routing works, in terms of the expectations around, you know, around job completion and like hyper low latency communications. So it's really, really fascinating to see kind of what, you know, what the requirements are. And again, this is where, when you're purpose built, you can, you know, you can focus in on the requirements of your customers much more effectively, which is fantastic. Honestly, I think it's a boon to just customers in general, and for, you know, giving us options, where we can do that cost benefit analysis that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, because when it comes down to it, it is eye-wateringly expensive. That's an understatement.
Ooh, yes.
To build your own AI training data center, if you're trying to build some sort of a model that's even remotely on par with like a foundation model, like a GPT or a Claude, which, you know, it's crazy. But even if you're training a model with just a couple hundred thousand parameters, which I know happens in industry and in university and education, I've worked with folks that do that. Okay. They're building their own models, and they're dramatically smaller because they're very, very focused and specific. It's still very, very expensive. I mean, they're going to pick up like one NVIDIA H100 or something like that, and that's like their budget. And here we're talking about building a data center, like a NeoCloud, right, where there's racks upon racks upon racks of these things to accommodate these very large AI training workloads. So I think that's, you mentioned a couple things. One is you mentioned Ethernet. And so I'll just throw out there that I think it's pretty clear that Ethernet won the Ethernet versus InfiniBand kind of battle with regard to, you know, model training.
Yeah.
And you still see InfiniBand out there. And I know there's people that are like religiously devoted to it, which is fine. But I think the underlying, you know, message there is, why do people care about InfiniBand? Well, lossless connectivity, extremely high speed connectivity. And that speaks to the very, very stringent requirements of training an AI model using this kind of like GPU architecture, right?
Yeah.
So you have 400, 800, 1.2, 1.6 terabit. I'm seeing like specs for like over 3 terabit per second connectivity, which I don't believe is in production yet. A lot of that stuff I see coming out from like Arista and things, and the Ultra Ethernet Consortium. Just insane bandwidth, but also that super ultra low latency, lossless connectivity. You cannot abide one packet drop. And then you get a retransmit, and your 1 millisecond of delay, you know, over months of training translates to huge amounts of time lost and money lost. So, you know, to optimize a general purpose data center for that is just crazy. And so I just, Cliff, I don't know about you, but I don't foresee most organizations building a data center like that. It just makes no sense. Or even trying to say, well, let's just portion off this third of our data center with this number of NVIDIA GPU clusters. I don't think that's feasible. It's just too expensive. It's requires different networking skills, things like that.
No, so, I think it's, in many ways, it's, I mean, again, some of the same impetus of like customers doing that analysis themselves of like, what types of apps should we move to, you know, your traditional public cloud. I mean, this is, you know, this is something that we went through 10 years ago and, you know, and we are kind of, history is repeating itself, but again, it's more just to teach us that, hey, that the, some of the principles, and the approach of doing that analysis is still critical, right? It's, you know, just because you have different options now doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, that you shouldn't necessarily follow the same process.
Yeah. I do remember when like, remember just not long ago when everybody started to talk about like repatriation and bringing workloads back on-prem because like, and I think what happened there during that whole conversation out there in like the tech world was not necessarily that we were wrong, everything needs to be on-prem. I think it was a realization that maybe we should look at this more strategically, workload by workload, app by app, case by case. But I don't know. I agree with you, Cliff, but I think it is a little bit more difficult to apply that completely. It's not analogous when we're talking about AI training because the cost is just, and it's just so much specific as far as what you're trying to do. Again, it's not general purpose, right? So I think, I mean, you know, and the folks that I talk to, the vast majority of people are, you know, network teams, IT teams, they're interested in AI stuff, but they're either not interested in training a model. They just want to use, you know, some model as a service.
Yep.
Or if they are going to train something, you know, it could be a fine tuning process, or they're going to run a very large footprint of a local model like a Llama, except they don't want to do it locally because they're going to run, you know, advanced inference. And those are all very few and far between. I really think that we're talking about, I don't know, 4 or 5% of enterprises out there. They're going to do something like that. That's why I think like NeoCloud makes a lot of sense because now it's like, well, I don't have to build anything, number one. So the build versus buy is out and, you know, you could scale up, scale down. It is as a service. So you know how that goes.
Yep. So I mean, you are still looking at lead times, right? I mean, ultimately, like, you know, which I think is interesting and why a lot of people are pushing from, you know, your traditional cloud providers, AWS, Azure, GCP, OCI, like you are looking at NeoClouds because they have access to the GPUs that you cannot get, you know, access to in the regions that you need potentially, you know, in any given time frame. So
that definitely plays into it. So you have the faster speed to market. And, you know, the hyperscalers are building their whole stuff and there's demand from AI startups now. So there's a whole new realm of this whole new cohort of companies that that require or at least want, you know, whether they require it or not, who knows, but they desire this hardware infrastructure to do what they're doing, their ideas. There's research institutions that are pushing this harder.
Yep.
You know, I remember in my own research over the past 4 or 5 years, I did this like survey of the history of AI and I really dug into some of the AI winters, and it's interesting to see that during a couple of those AI winters, like in the 70s, and there was another one in the mid 90s.
Because of Terminator, wasn't it?
Because of Terminator, it was not Terminator. And so people were like, what are we doing here? This is a waste of time.
Yeah.
No, but what happened was people didn't see the results that they expected. So, you know, it sort of died off as a thing, but also funding died off. And so saw less money and less interest, and therefore just a less need. And then, so that right now, I think that demand from startups, from educational institutions that just want to learn this stuff and develop models of their own and kind of go down that road, that's what's driving a lot of this. And because it's so much, like you said, there's GPU scarcity. And how do we do this? I want to do something next month or in a few months, and I can't. You know, the lead time to buy those NVIDIA GPUs is a year or 2 years. So
I think especially companies that are, you know, domain leaders in many cases and have the data, you know, are already in a place where, hey, it's, you know, labeled in the way that they need. And, you know, and it is more of a strategic advantage that they want to take advantage of. Like, yeah, you got to get on that now, right? I mean, like time matters here in terms of like competitive pressure and time to market of like what you can really kind of use with a purpose trained model that is specific to your domain.
Yeah, so we've talked about some advantages of why NeoClouds exist. Well, you can don't have to worry about building an AI data center. There's a purpose built data center that you can use as a service, and it has all of those infrastructure requirements built in, that ultra low latency, the scheduled fabrics, the extremely high band, it's all there, it's all ready to go, so you're good. You're not worried about a general purpose model, or rather general purpose data center. But also, you know, thinking about power and cooling, I mean, these data centers are built for this, so, you know, they're going to employ that liquid cooling, they're going to employ that maybe dedicated a power plant, you know, a power generation facility. Whereas if you're going to go down this road, you know, and let's say you want to augment your own data center or spin up a new building on your campus, if you're a larger organization, larger enterprise, you may not be able to do it simply because there's no way for that local municipality to get the power into you. Right. It's just not going to support it on your local grid. So there are other reasons that this just makes a lot of sense if this is the road you're going down, where you're training models and you just can't do it feasibly on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, I mean, it brings other components into play, especially when you think about, you know, kind of what your strategic direction is, I think, from a company perspective in terms of what infrastructure is strategically important for you to have yourself in comparison to what you should effectively not spend as much time or energy on, talent on in particular, right?
Yeah. Because who are some of the main players? I know like one. Who are the main players in this space?
Yeah, I think the one you probably know of, certainly CoreWeave, definitely kind of got there. But yeah, we've seen like Lambda Labs, Voltage Park, Together AI, like there's a number of that have really kind of sprouted up, and have either kind of come into the space from adjacencies or I know through Pivot, you know, because they had access to GPUs and good relationships with GPU vendors in particular.
Yeah. So then what would these NeoClouds compete on? I mean, if it's all very similar architecture, there's VXLAN, schedule fabrics, crazy fast bandwidth. Like, what are they competing on?
Yeah, I mean, in certain cases, certainly. I mean, there's a price component to it, you know, in terms of a race to the bottom there. But largely, I feel, I mean, we're starting to see some of them launch things like managed services around, around the. Kind of the fringes of what they're working on. So it's, you know, being able to host inference APIs more effectively. Maybe it's managed services for Kubernetes or for inference specifically that is attached to kind of the GPU infrastructure that you can effectively rent from them. Some of those things I think are really interesting because it does start to, if anything, kind of impede on more so what your traditional cloud providers are obviously have, right? So there's at least a few of the things that come to mind.
There's no real direct competition though. I mean, like Amazon has Amazon Bedrock, and I know that they have their own AI models, but they're not offering them as a service per se, where you're renting the GPUs to do your own thing. You're using their model as a service.
Right. So other than, with some of the traditional cloud providers, you can, you know, take a pre-trained model, you know, whether it's your model or obviously kind of theirs off the shelf. You can do additional fine tuning. You know, you can host, you know, inference APIs there. So there are definitely opportunities, and you know, you can see that that the cloud providers certainly have, you know, have kind of moved in the space. They're not, you know, just kind of sitting there waiting for GPUs to show up. And I do think like there's interesting decisions that customers have to make of when to start to leverage those services. You know, when is it more beneficial to have, you know, kind of the inference APIs closer to your application, closer to, you know, to the benefits that you get from a cloud provider, you know, around CDN and access to your customers and getting, you know, getting compute close to them. You know, there's still some benefits there where, you know, where I think there's decisions to be made for individual applications that that do depend on a bunch of your kind of traditional non-functional requirements, if you will.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about, you know, the assumption here is that you're almost certainly a multi-cloud environment. And so this app that you mentioned lives in, maybe it lives in AWS and wherever, you're in the US East region and then maybe multiple regions, whatever. You have other instances of things running in other clouds, other vendors. How does the Neo cloud fit into that? Are we, because I mean, we're doing that now in the sense of we have stuff moving around among clouds back on-prem, so it's not like it's a new thing.
No, that's right. Yeah, I mean, even, you know, even going to like the over the last couple of years, certainly it's been very common for, you know, customers using OpenAI endpoints or, you know, using Azure OpenAI, but doing that, you know, making calls from their AWS environment, from their GCP environment. So we've already been seeing, I feel like, some of this. Now, granted, it's been more what would be considered more SaaS traffic, if you will. This is obviously a little bit different in that this is obviously an IaaS, you know, an infrastructure as a service. And so, you know, again, because you have some of that flexibility of like, do I want my, you know, inference API over here? Do I want to, you know, copy my model out over into SageMaker or into, you know, Azure Machine Learning or into Vertex? You do have a little bit more flexibility there dependent on what your application requirements are. But we definitely have started to see, multi-cloud is not just a given application team has chosen, like, they want to host their stuff here and a different application team or a different BU business unit has, you know, has decided to host their, you know, their app over here. You're seeing a lot more crosstalk than ever before. And so, like, that has been, you know, some really fascinating kind of network implications and that certainly we are very interested in, as you can imagine, as Kentik.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, with what we do at Kentik, we're dealing with real-time or near real-time information telemetry, right? So, and we know how to do that. We have our data pipelines to accommodate that sort of thing. But if we are serving a model with new data and fresh data in near real-time, I mean, that poses challenges. Now, we do that already. We have an AI component to the platform that is able to answer questions about real-time data in natural language and then do some advanced analysis on that. And that's great. But for someone, I mean, I'm looking at this as a possible challenge. You know, if I am running in, you know, I'm training my own custom model, that's why I'm doing this NeoCloud thing, right? And I'm quote unquote renting GPUs, but we know it's more than that. It's the network and the fabric and everything. That's got to be a heavy lift to grab an entire, you know, model that I've trained and move it to a different NeoCloud provider, or I want to bring it on-prem. So, you know, I personally don't believe that people have much of a problem with vendor lock-in, not nearly as much as like the blogs would suggest. And, you know, we're all in with AWS. Okay. Is that vendor lock-in? Well, kind of, but you can move those workloads. Those workloads are not like proprietary AWS workloads. They're not necessarily here in the NeoCloud land, but it is a different animal. I mean, do you think that is a potential challenge for folks that are training models in CoreWeave or, you know, Lambda Labs or something?
I feel like, I mean, the community certainly around, you know, around AI and ML tools, especially, I feel like has done a really good job of ensuring that a lot of the, you know, the vendors in this space, you know, and all of them, including OpenAI and Claude and others that, I feel like there's been such a focus on kind of making these more ubiquitous, but then also not specifically locking people into a particular model. And even with MCP and, you know, A2A and kind of the back and forth there, like, those things are ultimately, you know, kind of more fungible than people would, yeah. You know, there's definitely some more, I would say, religious debates there that you could get into about what is, you know, thou shalt do it this way. When in reality, like, to your point, I mean, there's not actually as much lock in as, you know, as kind of people purport to be. A lot of it does come down to, I feel like, you know, operational skill set more than anything, because it, you know, that's really when rubber meets road. Is not, you know, it's not a day one problem. It's, you know, it's day two. And maybe that's more of an AWS-ism, if anything, but it's like, you know, it really is, you know, kind of building for what you can support as a team going forward. That becomes a much more critical element, I think. And, you know, ops teams are savvy, SRE teams, especially with automation and, you know, infrastructure as code and all of that, are able to kind of adapt. But I do think that a lot of it does come down to, you know, ops teams, you know, being able to reduce kind of operational burden, if anything. Yep. I'd like to, you know, given my time in kind of DevOps communities and all of that, I think grew and to appreciate that a lot more, and kind of the support burden that puts on ops teams.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, we had, you know, whatever kind of engineer, and then cloud came, and then we had cloud engineers. So operations, we talk about them like, oh, we've unburdened them because all your workloads are in the cloud and we manage a lot of that for you. But now we have new titles and new certification pathways and all that kind of thing. So I do wonder if we're going to see that here as well. I mean, you know, one thing I was thinking of, you know, with regard to staff and operations and skills that you mentioned, we're sort of democratizing access to AI. And when I say AI, I don't mean like access to more models that you can play with and vibe code your way into some app. But I mean access to, you know, a training environments where you can experiment if you have the, you know, the money. It's a lot easier to do that. You're literally saying, I have this budget. I'm going to do this for 3 months or 6 months and see what comes of it. It's a POC maybe. Who knows? But that's kind of new. Prior to that, it was restricted to mostly wealthy industry, not even academia as much, because even in, you know, most universities, you know, there are some with multi-billion dollar endowments, sure, aren't able to do that kind of stuff at scale that like an OpenAI or a Microsoft, well, they're kind of the same now, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
you're totally right. I mean, like ML ops teams, you know, that as a term even, I think kind of evolved. I'm sure there are teams that are still in, you know, kind of in that vein today, but largely, I do feel like some of that is becoming more of just kind of like ops skill set, you know, in the way that you know, operational responsibility does kind of matter for all of these teams. And you just need to kind of know what kind of workloads you're running.
Yeah. Yeah. As a side note, not really related to this topic, but I don't know if you remember, there was some blog posts and some discussion about a new type of engineer just called an operations engineer. And it was that idea of understanding workflows and not necessarily being like a double CCIE or a VCDX. Mm-hmm. Does anybody do VMware? Whatever the soup du jour is.
Yeah.
But the idea is somebody who's really a specialist in understanding workflows and pipelines, and they understand the basics of data engineering. They understand the basics of storage and networking, and they're able to be that operations person. So maybe that's more needful now, you know, more than ever.
That's definitely my sense. I mean, I see it more from the communication. Again, the more customers that I talk to and the different teams, like, you know, software's, it's, you know, a socio-technical problem, right? I mean, it's not fully technical. It's not just you know, communication, but it is the combination of the two. And I'm a firm believer in that. I mean, I see anything we can do to effectively make it such that, you know, in our case, network data can be communicated more effectively to more teams such that they can make better sense of it. Man, we're doing our job right there.
So let's talk about some of the, like, the future trends that you think of, you know, where do you see things going in the near term, in the short term? And I specifically mean with this idea of neo clouds, how people use them, you know, maybe those regulatory bodies that start to get involved, they always do after something gets popular. So what do you think?
It's got to be the case. Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if, again, it follows the same sort of trends where it's like, yeah, your traditional cloud environments eventually got to the place where, you know, data sovereignty and compliance and all of that, you know, those boxes need to be checked. And they are very important. I really don't mean to, kind of brush that under the rug or anything like that.
Yeah, right.
But that's definitely going to be the case, especially given the interest in, you know, in kind of neocloud in financial services environments and, you know, and media companies and, you know, and others. So I definitely think that's, you know, kind of one, you know, maybe more obvious one. I think prevalence of multi-cloud, and this is, you know, maybe not specific to NeoCloud again, but like NeoCloud is pushing that even more so. Because again, like this is effectively another cloud environment that you now need to now think about from an operational standpoint and how it communicates, you know, who has responsibility over it. You know, going back to what I said specifically about communications, like we interact with a lot of companies where, to your point, it's like, here's the cloud team and then here's the, you know, your network team otherwise. And it's like, why are those not one? And, you know, why are they not connected? Why can they not communicate with each other?
Right.
And so it's, you know, we're going to see that, you know, that uptick, I think, in the same way with NeoCloud. So it'll be interesting to see how, I think, like on the business model side, that things shift, because, you know, at some point, even with traditional compute and, you know, EC2 instances way back in the day, it was very much race to the bottom, and scale was really the most important characteristic. I'm not sure for NeoCloud if that's exactly what is, what is ultimately going to be the driver here. I feel like at some point, you know, there's not enough Microsofts and OpenAIs and whatever to basically, you know, require that level of that number of GPUs potentially.
Yeah.
And so like the market is very, you know, is very different, in comparison to, you know, traditional cloud computing.
Yeah. I feel like this whole, you know, the idea of NeoClouds are to AI today, kind of like what AWS was to, you know, web applications in like, what was that? 2005, 2006, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. So it's kind of that transition and shift, and then we'll see a normalization. I also wonder if we're going to see a consolidation of vendors. As you say, there's a race to the bottom and vendors do what they can to cut costs and they just aren't feasible financially. And so from a business perspective, perhaps and also based on the high capital cost of building and maintaining these data centers. And I did read just recently that there are some data center companies, and I don't mean data center company like an Equinix. I mean like, AI training facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And they're becoming geographically dispersed in that they can't get the power and cooling in one specific building or the building isn't big enough.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you're talking about running clusters in multiple geographic locations, then of course requiring the network to do that so it's successful. I wonder if, you know, we're going to see that happening with the whole NeoCloud, the future of NeoCloud, in that we're running certain workloads here, but maybe perhaps other AI training workloads over there for whatever reasons. And I mean, maybe it sounds silly right now, but I mean, who knows, right? I mean, we didn't anticipate having five different clouds and my front end is here, back end is there, storage is here, you know, and so.
Could just reserve the moon or something for, you know, NeoCloud data centers and then everything else? No.
I mean, they've been talking about, when I say they, that's like the ambiguous they, who are we talking about? But folks out there in social media and online and all that stuff, I've seen those comments about data centers in space, you know, orbiting data centers.
There we go.
And also on the moon and things like that. Because the latency between the Earth and the moon is fine. That's no problem.
Exactly. Yeah. No. InfiniBand, right? Solves all your problems. Isn't that the way it works out?
Yeah. Well, anyway, Cliff, I think we're going to end there just for the sake of time. So thanks so much for joining me today. This was a really interesting conversation. You know that I've been really into learning about AI and experimenting with it. I will not be renting any GPUs anytime soon in any of the Neo clouds, but it is so interesting to see the entire industry shift in this way. And what I'm personally most excited about is just the availability to train models, as long as you have the cash, right? But the availability out there to train models without having to wait for 3 years of environmental studies before you build your data center that you can't afford anyway, you know? So this is, that's what I'm personally most interested in and excited.
Yeah, that's awesome. Totally agree.
Great. Well, listen, I'm looking forward to having you on again soon and talk about clouds and cloudy things, because I know that's what you're an SME in, of course. So for our audience, if you have an idea for an episode or you'd like to be a guest on Telemetry Now, or if you have a comment about today's show, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us at telemetrynow@kentik.com. So for now, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.